board is now in session. Please be seated.
Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Robinson of the law firm Church of Slayton and Finger, and I rise today to introduce my co-counsel, Michael Cooper, of the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Mr. Cooper will be arguing on behalf of the defendants today.
Welcome, Mr. Cooper.
Thank you.
Morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. This is the time the court has set down for the oral argument case number 218-2005. Before I begin, I'd like to notify the court that I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal argument. I'd also like to introduce Ms. Laura Gundersheim of our New York office, who was a substantial help in the briefing on this appeal. May it please the court, the plaintiff's appeal, that part of the Court of Chancery's decision dismissing plaintiff's class action complaint, which asserted that Mr. William Harrison, the chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, violated his fiduciary duty of disclosure in connection with a stock-for-stock merger of J.P. Morgan and Bank One. The complaint alleges that Mr. Harrison violated his fiduciary duties in connection with material omissions of fact in the joint proxy that JPMC and Bank One circulated to solicit a shareholder vote on the merger. The merger, as I said, is a stock-for-stock acquisition of Bank One by JMPC. Each shareholder of Bank One received 1.32 shares of JPMC, valued at about $51 a share. The price was a 14% premium to Bank One's unaffected market price for the public announcement of the transaction back in January of 2004. The premium constituted about a $7 billion value in a transaction worth about $57 billion. Even though this transaction, this merger, was styled as an acquisition, it's important to note that post-transaction, the board of JPMC, which was the surviving company, consisted of 8 directors appointed by JPMC and 8 directors appointed by the Bank One people. This is despite the fact that the shareholders of JPMC controlled 58% of the outstanding shares of JPMC after the transaction. Now, a specific issue on this appeal is a deal that was offered by Mr. Diamond, former chairman of Bank One, in which he offered to have JPMC acquire Bank One at no premium if Mr. Diamond could immediately become the CEO of the joint entity after the transaction closed. This offer was turned down by Mr. Harrison, the CEO of JPMC, who wanted to continue on as CEO for a period after the transaction closed. Ultimately, they negotiate a situation or a deal whereby Mr. Harrison will remain as CEO for 2 years after the transaction closed, and then Mr. Diamond would take over. Thus, Mr. Harrison secured for himself not only the continuing title of CEO, but that continuing title for 2 years, as well as substantial benefits and pay perquisites and a change in his severance benefits in the event that he was dismissed without cause during that 2-year period. As we allege in the complaint, Mr. Diamond continues as, in fact, the CEO of the joint entity. And Mr. Harrison, although he has the CEO title, is really, in fact, a ceremonial figurehead of the company. Mr. Diamond is really functioning as the CEO. Now, this deal was not mentioned or referred to in the voluminous proxy statement that the two companies used to solicit shareholder votes. The proxy does contain details regarding the negotiations among the parties, negotiations between Mr. Harrison and Mr. Diamond. The defendants do not challenge that Mr. Harrison also had substantially assisted in the preparation of the joint proxy. Mr. Harrison also co-penned a letter that went out with the proxy material soliciting the shareholder vote urging the shareholders of JPMC to approve the transaction. Moreover, within the proxy statement, the fact of this two-year deal whereby Harrison would leave after 2 years after the transaction was mentioned as a factor in which both the JPMC board and the Bank Warden board approved the transaction. The truth didn't come out until an article appeared in the New York Times on January 27th, I believe, whereby secret negotiation between Harrison and Diamond was disclosed. This was approximately 4 days before the transaction closed on July 1st. The shareholders had approved the transaction back in May on May 25th. So the basic core of the disclosure of violations at issue on this appeal is that Mr. Harrison violated his fiduciary duty of disclosure and loyalty in failing to disclose that he had rejected the opportunity for JPMC to acquire Bank One without a premium, a $7 billion premium, for the purpose of securing for himself 2 additional years as CEO and the purposes of office.
If one took that statement that you just said and deleted the phrase violation of fiduciary duty and put in the phrase violated the United States securities laws, would that be an accurate statement from your perspective?
It depends, Your Honor, on a couple of things. First of all, the securities laws have a requirement of scienter. You know, there's a question of whether that would be you know, something that could be proven. Also, issues of causation, which is at issue. So it's possible that there would be a securities fraud violation, but certainly we believe on the facts pled in the complaint that there is a breach of fiduciary duty of disclosure under Delaware law.
So there are
standards that apply.
Such claims pending in the federal court, though, right?
Such claims are pending in the federal court. That is true.
Oh, while we're getting some details cleared up, is it your allegation or are there facts that would support the contention that Harrison also failed to advise his board of this possibility?
Yes, there are allegations in the complaint that he did fail to advise the board. There's also an alternative allegation that the board was aware of what had happened, but we believe that's really irrelevant for the ultimate issue on disclosure. If the board didn't know, certainly the violation of loyalty would accrue to Mr. Harrison. If the board did know and maybe approved it knowing about the transaction, still wasn't disclosed, and Mr. Harrison is still liable. So in either case, whether they knew or didn't know, it's our contention that Harrison can be held liable under violation of fiduciary duty of disclosure.
You stated all that as if it's a matter of fact. How did the vice chancellor deal with it for purposes of deciding the motion to dismiss?
I don't believe that the vice chancellor really took into account the knowledge or lack of knowledge by the board. It did come into account somewhat in his discussion of the what I call the transaction claims, where he said that demand was not shown to be futile in all instances. But again, the knowledge of the board with respect to the issue.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to focus on the knowledge of the board. I meant your first statement of fact, that there was the deal you've described, and that all it needs to do is be reported in the New York Times in order to be truth. Now, we all know the New York Times only prints that which is true, but how did he deal with it?
I believe that the vice chancellor did not necessarily accept the truth of that allegation.
Why not?
He made reference to the federal complaint that was pending and said that the federal complaint had pled that there was no knowledge. I think we explained in our brief that that was not the case, that the federal complaint, frankly and unfortunately, was filed by a former associate of mine who had worked in this firm, and there's a whole history behind that. Number two, he complained and cited Section 220 of the Books and Records and said that we should have done a Books and Records action to discover whether, in fact, they knew or didn't know. We said in our briefs we thought that was inappropriate, not necessarily fair in the circumstance for two reasons. Number one, we didn't pursue a Books and Records case, and we're certainly participants in the Disney litigation. We're cognizant of the Books and Records requirement, how that can help the derivative case go forward. But number one, we didn't believe was a derivative case to begin with, and number two, we had a two-day time frame in which to file this complaint. The vice chancellor took us to account by saying we didn't file a TRO, but on the same breath, he said we should have filed a 220 action. So one has to wonder how we could have done that. It just doesn't make sense to us. So I don't believe that he truly accepted the validity and truth of the claim that the board did not know, and that Harrison kept it undisclosed. But even if he kept it undisclosed, as I said, I don't think that would impact the underlying disclosure claim, because if the board knew and Harrison knew and nobody disclosed it, still a disclosure claim because it wasn't disclosed.
Well, let's put aside for a moment what the board knew or didn't know, and whether or not a 220 action would have produced board minutes that would have answered that question. Just put that to the side. What supports the Harrison deal or the Diamond deal offered to Harrison other than one line in the New York Times?
Your Honor, what we're relying on is the New York Times article. We don't have any other evidentiary support pled in our complaint for the fact that there was this deal that was turned down.
Well, if that's the only source the fact to document the deal, and the vice chancellor is considering in the context of a motion to dismiss, how did he handle it?
Well, like I said, I don't, Your Honor, I don't think he really took, in, I don't think he took the truth of that statement asserted, while he may have taken it into account, it appears in his opinion, I don't think he really believed it. And, we have a notice pleading standard and a class claim under Rule 8. And it's a well-pled fact. The defendants were certainly aware of the allegation. When the complaint was filed, they went ahead and proceeded to close the merger. They proceeded at their own risk. I have not seen, and we've never seen, a denial from the defendants, from any other source, that this is inaccurate and untrue. It's not the record. We did.
Is your appeal on the disclosure issue one that's focused on he should have taken that as truth and not dismissed the case, or is it that, in addition to that, you clearly stated a breach of a duty of disclosure claim under Delaware law, given the one sentence in the New York Times being the factual support for it?
It's the latter, Your Honor. The Vice Chancellor, when you look at the back of his opinion where he talked about the disclosure claims in this case, he appeared to have accepted the truth of our pleading. He actually went so far as to say that it was possible that we could have had injunctive relief had we moved for a TRO at the time, but that since we didn't at that time, it was too late. And so his analysis and dismissal of the case was based solely upon his legal conclusion, not factual finding, but legal conclusion necessarily, that what happened was the damages in our case on the disclosure claim were so similar and intertwined with damages he found to be derivative, and he also found that there's no possibility of nominal damages that we did not state a claim. So our analysis, our focus on this appeal is the damage analysis under Tooley.
Okay, I've interrupted you enough. Get to the point then on how he erred as a matter of law in reaching the conclusion.
Okay, two points. Number one, it is our contention that the court's decision in Malone on page 12 of that opinion, where it said, an action for a breach of fiduciary duty arising out of disclosure violations in connection with a request for stockholder action does not include the elements of reliance, causation, and actual quantifiable monetary damages. That language was interpreted in the O'Reilly versus Transworld case to mean what it said, that there is a right of relief for nominal damages when there is a violation of the fiduciary duty of disclosure in a case such as this involving a transaction because the shareholder franchise, the ability to cast an informed vote, has been implicated and violated. It's consistent with, as the court said in O'Reilly, with the underlying notion that Delaware law places emphasis real emphasis on informed shareholder voting. Defendants have come back with Loudon and said, well, no. Malone is just citing his dicta, and Loudon really said that there's no underlying per se rule for nominal damages in disclosure cases. But Loudon, again, should be read to be limited to its facts. Loudon involved disclosure of wrongdoing during an election of directors. The directors in that case had been elected. The court remarked that their terms had come and gone, and that the bottom line was there was no real damage that accrued to the shareholders. It was merely just a damage to an election. There was no hard damage to speak of. In O'Reilly, the court actually found that there was no right to compensatory damages for certain of plaintiff's disclosure claims, yet denied the motion to dismiss with respect to on this notion of that there was a failure to cast an informed vote. We are not trying.
Brown also talked about this court's refusal to recognize a fraud on the market theory and the separate role of the federal securities laws as opposed to creating new causes of action under the guise of fiduciary duty. How do you get around that? I mean, why shouldn't the claim that you've been raising here be limited to a federal securities claim? Because the Delaware statutes say what must be disclosed, and there's no allegation here that the actual transaction itself, the merger deal, was not disclosed.
Well, Your Honor, my understanding of Delaware precedents is that under Delaware standards, it's really an issue of materiality. You know, the statutes do say what should be disclosed, but there has been a wide and vibrant case law that's developed over the issue of materiality. If it takes a actual significance by a reasonable shareholder and affects the total mix of information, it's something that needs to be disclosed. The courts have also been absolutely clear that if you solicit a shareholder vote, you have an obligation and a duty to speak truthfully and fairly with the shareholders. It arises from the fiduciary duty of loyalty and the fiduciary duty of good faith. So the Delaware courts have never shied away from finding disclosure violations, even though there is a separate body of federal law out there. And I will note that the Vice Chancellor tried to import federal law into this case by citing the Supreme Court's decision in Dura, which involved an issue of causation, a finding of causation was necessary to plead a 10B case. That has not been the case under Delaware law, not as I read O'Reilly and the court's decision in Malone, where it explicitly said causation is not an element of the cause of action. I'd like to say that, finally, it's not just about nominal damages. There's the issue of economic injury and the issue of voting power dilution. In this case, there was voting power dilution. The minority shareholders went from, the JPMC shareholders went from a 61% ownership interest to a 58% ownership interest. Now, some people may say, so what? What does it matter? But there was voting power dilution. In the TriStar case, and it's very important for the court to focus on TriStar, because what often gets overlooked in TriStar is the fact that the minority shareholders in that case went from about 43% voting power to 20%. And what the court spoke about there was, and I'm quoting from page 330 of the court's opinion, that what was pled was no more than a relative diminution in the minority's proportionate influence over corporate affairs that indisputably occurred in this situation. The minority shareholders in TriStar never had control of the company. They were always minority shareholders in a company dominating control by Coke. They went from 43% minority shareholders to 20%. So if the court adopts the court's reasoning below, which was you need to be diluted to, quote, almost oblivion, then what the court's saying is there has to be some kind of numerical element, some kind of black line law that says if you go from, 10 to 5, that's not good enough, but somehow 10 to 2 is good enough. We think that since we've shown at least a diminution in voting power dilution, we state a claim, a class claim, for damages under TriStar and its precedent. Finally, on economic injury, we rely upon what we said in our briefs, but here, again, the shareholders paid a $7 billion premium for this transaction. The recovery would not just go to post-transaction JPMC. Recovery will only go to the JPMC, the former JPMC shareholders. If it goes to the Bank One shareholders, two, they receive a windfall. I see that I'm into my sum up time here, Your Honor, so if I have any more questions, I'll take it. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Cooper, and I'm grateful for the privilege of appearing before this court. I appear for the defendant, appellee William Harrison, who, as my friend said, is the chairman and CEO of the merged bank, as he was of Chase before the merger. I probably shouldn't use precious time clearing up a point which is not critical to your decision, But I think in response to your question, Justice Berger, is there an allegation in the amended complaint that Mr. Harrison concealed this deal, the offer, from his board? The answer is there is no such allegation in the amended complaint. The vice chancellor asked, oral argument, asked counsel for the plaintiffs three times, not once or twice, whether their claim was that the board had rejected the offer as an accommodation to their friend, the person to whom they were beholden, or whether he had concealed the offer from them. And three times, plaintiff's counsel said, no, we admit that the claim is that the board knew and rejected it. I just refer the court to pages 20, 32, 57, and 73 of the transcript of that argument. Now, there's only one issue on this appeal, and that is whether the plaintiffs have stated a cognizable disclosure claim for damages. But it's important to recognize that the Vice Chancellor decided two other issues, which are an essential predicate for resolving the disclosure issue. He decided that the claim that J.P. Morgan Chase had paid an unnecessary premium of $7 billion was a derivative claim, not a direct claim. They had basically overpaid for an asset. That argument is not being, that decision is not on appeal here. He also decided that the plaintiff had failed to overcome the two-part test in Aronson because the board here, 12 people, 11 of whom other than Mr. Harrison were outside directors with no other involvement with Chase than being directors. They were independent, disinterested, and there was enough information before them, he found, he ruled, for them to make an informed judgment as to proceed with the merger on the terms that were disclosed in the proxy statement. And I should say there is no argument here that the proxy statement did not disclose the terms of the actual merger transaction accurately in every single respect. It is not challenged on any ground that it misdescribes any of the terms of the actual transaction. Now, the issue, as the Vice Chancellor put it, is whether this class-based disclosure claim can exist as a claim for money damages apart from the underlying claim, where the damages allegedly flowing from the disclosure violation are exactly the same as those allegedly suffered by JPMC in the underlying claim, to wit, the premium, the overpayment of the premium. Now, plaintiffs admit in their reply brief at the very first page that they have to allege an injury that is distinct from the injury for which damages would be sought in the derivative suit. But in fact, they have not alleged an injury that is distinct.
What about the idea that they're entitled to nominal damages for a disclosure violation, assuming for the moment that there is a disclosure violation?
Assuming there is a disclosure violation, as I understand the law in this state, nominal damages are not available in the absence of a showing of an impairment of economic interest or a dilution or deprivation or impairment of voting rights. That was the holding in Loudon. That's quite clear, is that statement I just made. It's in the Chief Justice's opinion for the en banc court. Now, in the Malone case, the court quoted that statement, but elided the middle of it, which is the critical part. The Malone case, and I'll tell you exactly where the elision is, said, this is Loudon. In Loudon, quoting, where directors have breached their disclosure duties in a corporate transaction, dot, 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 there must be an award of nominal damages, at least. But if you go back to Loudon, you'll see that what the dot, dot, dot was, and that was where directors have breached their disclosure duties in a corporate transaction. turn caused impairment to the economic or voting rights of stockholders, there must at least be an award of nominal damages. So the requirement of an impairment to the economic or voting rights of stockholders is necessary for either nominal damages or compensatory damages. The point of awarding nominal damages in a case like that is that occasionally you can't quantify proof with evidentiary proof what the compensatory damages is, so nominal damages are awarded in the absence of that specific proof.
Now, if I understand what you're saying the Delaware law is right now, a stockholder can bring a direct disclosure claim if it is to seek an injunction of a pending transaction. However, there is no viable disclosure claim post-merger or post-transaction for even nominal damages unless there is also an underlying claim of economic loss or voting rights loss.
I would say I agree with you except for the word underlying. There has
okay.
to be a part of they have to show impairment of an economic interest or voting rights. And let me turn to those elements because...
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Which may let you help me figure out what we mean by an impairment of voting rights.
Yes.
If information that would be material to a reasonable shareholder in casting his or her vote is not disclosed, and the shareholder votes in favor of a merger, not knowing that there might have been a better offer on the table earlier, which was rejected as a result of a breach of the duty of disclosure, is that not under Delaware law an impairment of voting rights?
I don't think it is in the sense in which the courts discuss the availability of a cause of action for damages, either individual or class-wide, for a breach of the duty of disclosure. When the courts talk about impairment of voting rights, and my friend referred to the TriStar case, and I agree with him, that is the classic illustration and contrast here. They are comparing the voting rights of one or more pre-merger shareholders with the voting rights of other pre-merger shareholders. In TriStar, the minority shareholders saw their interest in the aggregate drop from 43.4% to less than 20%. The significance of that is that they were unable to prevent a freeze-out merger, whereas the largest single shareholder, Coca-Cola, saw its interest increase from 36 to 80%. Here, the voting rights of all pre-merger JPMC shareholders remain precisely the same. This case is more like a case called Paxson Shareholders Litigation, where the shareholders claimed that their interests were improperly diluted, their voting rights, when Paxson entered into a series of transactions with NBC, under which, if NBC exercised all of its rights, there were options and warrants, if they exercised all those rights, NBC would have 49% of the equity and 70% of the voting power. And the plaintiff shareholders would have 51% of the equity, not 100, and 30% of the voting power. Now, that's considerably more of a dilution than anything that's mentioned here, even if you compare post-merger and post-merger. But this is what Chandler said about that claim. To the extent any alleged decrease in the asset value and voting power of plaintiff shares results from the issuance of new shares to a third party, here the shareholders of Bank One, plaintiff's dilution theory as a basis for a direct claim fails, and any individual claim for dilution must be dismissed. So I submit that in this context, impairment of voting rights and dilution of voting rights means vis-a-vis other shareholders of the pre-merger entity. As far as impairment of economic rights...
Control doesn't matter then?
Excuse me?
Your opponent is arguing that the proportionate share of control is what has been diminished. That's not important?
The pre-merger JPMC shareholders had, post-merger, 61% of the voting power of the combined entity. They should have had, excuse me, I beg your pardon, I misspoke, they had 58%. So as a group, all public shareholders, there were no major shareholders in this corporation, as a group they had control. He said they should have had 61%. That wouldn't have been a change in control. It would have been an increase in control from 58 to 61%. But they were in control either way, Your Honor. Now, as far as the economic impact of this alleged withholding and non-disclosure of the offer and refusal, as I noted earlier, the plaintiffs have an interest in the post-merger institution, which was accurately described in the proxy statement. There's been no impairment of their actual economic interest. The argument is that they were deprived of an opportunity. They should have had an opportunity to vote. To turn down that deal because the premium was being paid. Now, I don't know of any case in this court, or indeed in any other court, in Delaware or out, that equates a lost opportunity with an impairment of an existing economic interest. But even if you could draw that equation, let's look at the economic, the opportunity here, the lost opportunity. It is so speculative that I believe to have disclosed it would itself have been misleading. Why is it speculative? It assumes that the board of JPMC would have accepted that offer. But we know from the allegations of the complaint, they turned it down. It assumes further that the board of Bank One would have accepted that deal and foregone a $7 billion premium to their shareholders. It assumes further that the financial advisor at Bank One would have rendered a fairness opinion under those circumstances. And finally, it assumes that the shareholders of Bank One would have been sufficiently altruistic that they would have foregone a $7 billion premium.
Can I shift the focus a little bit to my concern, which is the idea that you can have a bona fide disclosure violation, some material issue of fact that would make a difference to a reasonable stockholder that has been misstated or omitted. And yet there is no claim available if you don't find out about it and do something before the transaction. So, for example, if, and I know this isn't a great one, but I wasn't able to come up with something better, but let's say the description of the Bank One directors who would be joining the combined board was wholly misleading, and in fact, they are all a bunch of scoundrels who, you know, shouldn't be trusted with a dime. Just for purposes of discussion, and after the transaction, the stockholders of JPMC find out that we were misled about what this deal was going to encompass in terms of who's going to run our new company. No claim. That's what you're saying under Delaware law, there'd be no claim at all.
There would be no claim for damages.
Well, but what other claim would there be because the transaction's already done?
Well, the transaction wasn't done here, but I'll come back to that.
Assume.
But assuming it's done, They can certainly vote them all out. Remember, this group of misled JPMC shareholders has 58% of the vote of the post-merger entity. Mm-hmm. They can vote them out of office. That's what they can do. And maybe there are some other equitable remedies, Your Honor. I hadn't really thought through, but there might be some other equitable remedies, too. I think, Your Honor, the only other point I'd like to make, answer any remaining questions you have, is, by the way, there's additional authority for my point that disclosure claims which do not involve, assert, a demonstrable injury to economic interest or voting power cannot sustain a claim for damages, only for equitable relief. And that was held in the Triard case as well by the Chancery Court. Now, even if this court were to hold that all of the elements that we've been discussing of a disclosure claim for damages were present, I submit the decision below should be affirmed on the independent ground that the alleged offer and refusal, as Your Honor said, one sentence in a newspaper story, that was not a material fact requiring disclosure. And I will tell you why. We argued this to the Vice Chancellor. He felt that he didn't have to reach the point. As I said 2 or 3 minutes ago, that lost opportunity was about as ephemeral as it could have been, because of all of the different bodies that would have had to approve it that didn't approve it, and one of which actually turned it down, the JPMC board. And I submit to have disclosed something which was turned down and was not available as an alternative would itself have been misleading. Beyond that, this arose in the midst of merger negotiations, parry and thrust, feint and counterfeint, asserting the position having to do with compensation and trading that off against some other term of the transaction. No case requires that the details of positions taken, whether they're serious, whether they're testing, any positions taken in merger negotiations need be disclosed in a merger proxy statement.
But if they are disclosed, shouldn't they be accurate?
Yes, they should. And what there is no, this is a pure omission statement. It's not a statement that rendered any statements that were made inaccurate. It's a pure omission statement. The closest thing that one could find to a statement rendered inaccurate is a statement of the proxy statement, which we quote, that the boards of JPMC considered succession arrangements. It was an important factor to them, as indeed it was. I would just point to the Santa Fe Railway case, where it was held that a court that a proxy statement need not disclose another transaction that was under consideration, to the Siliconics case. And I would say that any other result would bury the shareholders with unneeded information. It would breed spurious litigation about whether possibilities were should have been pursued that weren't, and it would make it impossible for parties to negotiate a merger. Thank you.
Thank you.
I realize my time is very limited. I'll just address some points in rebuttal quickly here. In terms of my opponent's statement regarding the allegation that you have to show economic and voting power injury, even with respect to an effect on the voting rights of shareholders, that was questioned and rejected in the court's decision, lower court's decision in O'Reilly, footnote 25, where it said, appears that under Loudoun's pleading standards, even a claim for nominal damages would need be accompanied by an allegation that the disclosure violation impaired stockholder voting rights or impaired stockholders of their economic interests. This view, however, is inconsistent with Malone's pronouncement that causation is not an element of a claim for breach of fiduciary duty of disclosure.
And footnote 58, Vice Chancellor Lamb says that the O'Reilly case, which is also a Court of Chancery decision, is not the law, and has Loudoun and its relationship to TriStar and Malone versus Crinkett wrong. Can you explain footnote 58 to me?
I can. I think the Vice Chancellor, I think what the Vice Chancellor said was he disagreed with the holding in O'Reilly. And I think what is necessary is a very close examination of the court's decision, both in Malone, Loudoun, and TriStar. My opponent mentioned the Triar case. Again, it's a case involving approval of executive compensation brought 3 years after the transaction closed, had nothing to do with voting dilution, had nothing to do with economic injury to shareholders in a transaction that occurred here.
I know you're almost out of time. Well, you are out of time. Can I ask him a question?
Sure.
What's your response to the alternative argument by opposing counsel that this case should be thrown out because you haven't stated a material omission?
I don't want to go on for 10 minutes, but I will say that if there's anything that is material, it is what occurred here. This was a quid pro quo. This wasn't some rejected offer that came along and, you know, courts say over and over again, well, you know, an offer that isn't necessarily an offer or an expression of interest in a transaction case is not material. The sky has been falling here. We allege that the chairman and chief executive officer of J.P. Morgan is now the chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan because he turned down an offer to do a deal at no premium, but he wanted to keep his title for 2 years. This, under any standard of materiality, is something that shareholders would consider important in deciding how to vote their shares. The rest of the arguments, I think, we can go down the list, but what happened here was it did happen. The transaction we're complaining about did occur. There was a $7 billion overpayment in violation of fiduciary duties of both of Mr. Harrison, both in loyalty and terms of disclosure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you very much for this argument. I think you've crystallized the issues very nicely for us, and we look forward to getting you a result as soon as we possibly can. With that, it's under advisement, and we're adjourned.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart.